Welcome to Wherever You Are. My name is Ryan McNeil in Toronto, Canada, and you are listening to episode 107 of the Matinee Cast. It's the movie-loving podcast of my movie-loving website, matinee.ca, your home for cinematic passion and perspective. Folks, there's two things going on around this recording of episode 107 that I'm really, really happy about. One is that we have finally reached the month of March, because Lord knows there has been precious little to watch in the theater this year. I mean, there is nothing out there right now that I feel like spending 75 minutes talking about for your listening enjoyment. So for the love of God, I'm happy that February and January are behind us. The other thing that's going on that has influenced this episode is the third year now of the Blind Spot series, which right about now you'll hear Matthew Brown and Matthew Price tuning out if you listen very closely. But the Blind Spot series is now in its third year, and it's actually become really, really popular. When we first started it, there were anywhere between, you know, 8 or 10 entries, sometimes down to just 3 or 4 in some slower months. But now we're up north of 20 for most months, and it seems to be growing all the time. So I decided that with nothing else out there and the Blind Spot series doing so well in 2014, that we would dedicate an entire episode to blind spotting. There's no Know Your Enemy, there's no Feedback, and there's no Other Side for this episode. We are just going to talk about a collection of 6 blind spots from 6 different writers in 6 different countries. So we'll skip from person to person. You'll hear the musical cues in between like usual. But join me for this little trip around the world. I'm really excited about this episode. We'll start the tour right after this. We're across a wire to Germany. We're talking to the brains behind Lime Reviews and Strawberry Confessions. She is also one of the chicks with accents on the Across the Universe podcast. We have Mette Kowalski with us. How are you?
Hi, Ryan. I'm good.
That's good. How are you? I'm pretty well. A little bit groggy for this segment, but I'm okay. So for your blind spot for this month, you watched a film which is not really that old, but you're not even the first person to watch it this year, because somebody watched it in January as well. Oh. You watched, you watched a film which was released widely in 2001, but it's listed as a 2000 film. You watched Christopher Nolan's Memento.
Yeah.
And before we get to what you thought, because blind spots, of course, come with baggage, what were some of your preconceptions going into Memento? Like, did you have any at all, or were you just ready to sit down and watch a movie?
No, I was. First of all, a lot of people know that I came into the kind of film blogging community and stuff through Bollywood. So there's this Bollywood remake of Memento by...
Is there?
Yeah, there is. With one of the big Indian movie stars, who is actually pretty good too. Like, he does some kind of intellectual stuff too. Okay. But this was kind of his action movie debut or something. And yeah, so it's more of an action movie, and it's kind of okay, but there are songs and dance, and it was just okay. But yeah, and then I knew, of course, the story, and that it was kind of chronological. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And yeah, but I didn't know that much. I knew the tattoo stuff. And,
oh, okay. So how did it work out for you?
It worked really well. I immediately really loved this movie, because I couldn't stop. You know, I really wanted to watch it all the time, not take my eyes off the screen. And I just kept, you know, thinking about what all of this would lead up to. And yeah, it's just very engaging for the audience. Like, it's not one of those quiet dramas where you really have to force yourself to be concentrated, but it's super suspensive, I think.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy, because this is a movie that I didn't see this in a theater. I a friend of mine told me about it by the time it had hit DVD, like around the year it came out. I watched it in 2001, but I didn't come into it until after it played its very short run in like just two or three theaters in Toronto. And when I watched it, I think my jaw was on the floor almost the whole time at how amazing a story it was. So I guess the obvious question is, because you already mentioned the reverse chronology, if there is anybody out there who's never seen Memento, it's a story that's told backwards. And so you watch a scene, you get to the end of it, and then the next scene you watch happens that leading into the scene that you just watched. So it all happens in reverse order. Do you think that was a gimmick, or do you really think that is part of what makes this film work?
I guess it is. I mean, I thought about this, whether it would be interesting at all if they just told it in normal order. Mm-hmm. I think it would have been an okay movie because the story is actually not that bad. But just this reverse storytelling makes it more special and makes the ending, makes it just end with a bang.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's kind of crazy. I don't know. I don't know exactly how you watched it, but there are copies of the DVD out there where you can actually watch it in chronological order. And it even drops the black and white scenes where he's talking on the phone. It even drops them into the right place as well.
Oh, wow.
And it is kind of crazy to watch it in that particular order. Now, it's also kind of funny that you mentioned that you saw the Bollywood remake of it, because that happened to me for my my January entry for The Blind Spot. I'd watched the crummy remake of the film I was watching. Now, did you find that affected your viewing at all? Like, did you have the same sort of enjoyment of the film, kind of knowing where it was all going?
I actually think the Bollywood movie has a different ending.
Oh, really?
And it's also not really told backwards. It's more of like a flashback-filled kind of thing.
Oh, okay.
But I don't really remember it that much. But the ending was definitely not the same.
Oh, okay, okay. But so that's the thing, just because I get always amused with how we're in a time of spoiler culture, right? Like people don't want to know what happens in the opening credits anymore. And that was something I noticed with my film, was that even though I knew how it was going to end, it didn't affect my enjoyment. And I guess you're saying the same thing. Even though you knew the main structure of the movie, like everything down to the tattoos, it didn't affect your enjoyment.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I mean, there are the big things, like, I don't know how I did it, but I managed to watch Fight Club without knowing how it ended. I definitely think that makes it a better experience.
It probably would have.
But like the small stuff, I think people are over sensitive about that these days.
No, of course. I guess this probably... you know, Christopher Nolan is kind of a god in amongst our blogging community, of course. Is it kind of crazy to kind of go back to the beginning and see where people started freaking out over him?
Well, I have to admit that I haven't seen many of his movies.
Really?
I mean, he doesn't have many, but I've seen Inception and The Dark Knight.
Okay.
But I don't even know if I've seen Batman Begins. I'm not sure about that.
He doesn't have very many, so it's, you know, you're not missing too much. Although, actually, now that you mention it, I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on Insomnia, because that's based on a Swedish movie that you might have seen already. Did you ever see that movie?
It's also called
Insomnia. It's with Stellan Skarsgård.
No, I don't think so. Maybe when I was smaller, but I don't remember that.
Didn't stick. Your podcast did an episode a while ago about film noir, and this is kind of a neo-noir. Did you like the way that it worked with those kind of story elements and those kind of story tropes, where you've got a femme fatale really in Carrie-Anne Moss and,
And she's kind of a good femme fatale now that I think about it. And you've got a detective and you've got a grim story. Did you find that this could have been a really good inclusion into your noir conversation?
I guess, yeah. I know that Nick has seen it. I guess, I don't know if Sophia has seen it. But, well, we could have mentioned it, but it's, I always find it hard to, like, determine a new noir because, yeah, it's just, I guess it has some of those elements, but I looked at it more like a modern kind of movie, but.
Well, it's one of those terms that gets thrown around a lot, right? And it's,
yeah.
And it's not always appropriate. Like, for every film, like, it's kind of funny because Guy Pearce stars in another neo-noir with L.A. Confidential. But for every L.A. Confidential and Memento, you get all sorts of kind of crummy films that are treading on the name kind of badly. Was there anything else about the movie that jumped out at you in watching it this first time?
Definitely the black and white scenes. I liked how they did that because it kind of confuses you even more. The way that it really makes you feel like you're the main character because you don't know what's going on. And it felt like more of a reading a novel kind of experience because you're not just witnessing what's happening. You actually feel like you're the main character.
Yeah, it's... I think the freakiest thing about this movie, I rewatched a few scenes before we started talking, and the thing that most disconcerting is the idea of not being able to trust your own memory. There's the scene in the diner where Leonard is talking about how police don't always trust eyewitness accounts. They make notes and they draw conclusions because memories can change the layout of a room and they can change the color of a car. And when you think about how much you rely on your own memory, the idea that memory is fallible is a really dark idea.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a big fan of the new Sherlock Holmes series of the BBC.
Yeah, yeah.
And it plays a lot on that kind of thing that, you can't really trust most people's memories. And actually, I also talked... this is more about this kind of disease. I don't know what it's called, but that he has with the memory thing.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about it that you can kind of learn things by instinct, and that maybe that's how animals actually learn things. Because you say that a lot of animals forget what they just did like a few minutes after that.
Oh yeah. And that comes up, right? That there's, even if he has this condition and the test case that he keeps talking about throughout the movie, Sammy Jenkins, even though he has this condition, he shouldn't have to rely on his notes and his tattoos to keep things. There are some things that he should be able to instinctually recall. That gets down. Like, I know if you dig into the science of it, I think it doesn't entirely hold up. But, you know, hey, it's a movie, right? that's a really good point that besides the fallibility of our own memories, there is something to be said about our own animal instincts that this movie brings up. So just to wrap it up, was there anything about Memento that surprised you that played against your preconceptions or that you didn't really see coming, for better or for worse?
Definitely, again, the ending. It's
you didn't think it was going to be quite that bleak?
No. I didn't expect that at all. I mean, when that was kind of forming in my head, that idea was just, wow, oh my God.
Yeah.
It's just a great twist that I really didn't see coming at all.
The very notion of, do we lie to ourselves to be happy?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Matt. I'm glad that your blind spot worked out for you. Lord knows they don't always, they're not always winners. If people want to find more of your work, where can they find you online?
They can find my blog on limereviews.blogspot.com. I'm on Twitter at Matt Kowalski. And I also, I'm on like Tumblr, and I recently started a YouTube channel with my sister.
Yes, you did.
So you can find all of those things on my blog, I guess.
And where can people find the podcast?
That is also on the blog, and our Facebook page is facebook.com/AcrossTheUniversePodcast. We're on iTunes, Podomatic. We recently joined Stitcher, so.
Nice. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, too. Thanks for having me.
We're across the wire now to Pune, India. We're talking to the brains behind youandmefilms.blogspot.com. He is a longtime friend of the site and somebody who I'm happy to finally be talking to. We're talking to Shantanu Gumare. How are you, sir?
I'm very fine. How are you?
Not bad. It's already tomorrow in India. Every time I'm talking ahead of time in time zones, it really screws me up.
Yeah. So how, it's already Saturday morning here.
Yeah, how is the future? Do you guys have hoverboards yet?
No, not too different, actually. It doesn't look anything different from yesterday night at all.
That's disappointing. Your blind spot for this month was a cultural touchstone, a cultural flashpoint, if you will. You
went unfortunately for the wrong reasons.
Yeah. You went back to 1941 and watched John Ford's Best Picture-winning film, How Green Was My Valley. And before we get into the actual plot and everything like that, I've been starting people with their preconceptions. So did you have any preconceptions of How Green Was My Valley going in?
Actually, I tried not to. I didn't pick this for the obvious reasons. I picked it only because I wanted to see Best Picture winner. I've been trying to get through all of them. So this was my Best Picture winner this year. I didn't pick it because it was the film to beat Citizen Kane.
Okay. But that obviously, that would be kind of the we'll get back there, I'm sure. But I guess that would be the only preconception that goes along with it is this beat Citizen Kane for Best Picture, so it must be really damn good.
Yeah, it's actually the other way around. I didn't go into this thinking about it. I wanted to see it just because it won the Best Picture.
Gotcha.
I didn't want to compare it to Citizen Kane.
Okay, and what did you think?
It took me a little while to get into it. It took me some warming up for the film, but by the end, I was into it. I was pretty much into the film.
Well, that's good. To tell people about it, it's about a village in, I think it's a village in Wales. Yes, it's a village in Wales.
South Wales.
During the 19th century, and it's a mining town. It's very much the story of one family. They have, five sons, I think?
I think six.
Six.
Including the narrator, the sixth one.
Right. And everybody goes to work in the mine except for the youngest one, who kind of seems to be the great hope of the family. And it's about looking back on his past in Wales and just, you know, the innocence of youth, the small town life, and basically, like, it's a story very much about family.
They concentrate completely on one family and how they travel through the time.
Yeah, and which is kind of, I was actually interested that this was your choice for the month because the last film that I did for The Blind Spot in 2013 was Tokyo Story, and I remember actually you left a comment on my post talking about the difference in the family dynamic. That it is in North America, and I'm not sure if it was maybe different in what you saw in this Welsh family, and what you're accustomed to. Did you notice any kind of similarities or difference in the story of a family?
Actually, this is probably much more closer to the home to me. This sort of family dynamics, the family staying together, the patriarchal figure for the father, the way they respect the father, they just kind of they have to almost take permission from their father just to speak every time. So that was much more closer to home for me, because in India pretty much we have a much similar culture. It has evolved over the years, obviously, but the culture is much more similar to. So Tokyo Story was a little bit different from the I think my perspective for the Tokyo Story was a little bit different from this, but I think this one, as a family, if you're talking specifically about the family, my perspective for it was much more closer to home.
So now, of course, the next thing from there is that not only is there the family dynamic happening in terms of this very patriarchal dynamic, but because it's a small town, and it's a small town where everybody grows up together, it kind of turns into this extended family. Now, I must admit, I know zero about your home city, so I do plead ignorance. But did, was that striking a chord too, or is that is that more of a stretch?
No, I think it was some sort of corollary to that as well. I recently moved somewhere else, but I used to live for 20 years in some, you can say something like a small building there. Okay. And this was very much like my old house. So the whole building which we used to live there was like a big extended family. So this was actually very similar, or something which I can completely relate to.
Yeah, and it's the thing about how green was my valley is that it's interesting because you realize that this extended family of a small community, whether it's a Welsh community or a building in India or even a small town in Canada or America, it can be both a blessing and a curse, because we watch as these people, they help each other a lot, but they really kind of get in each other's way too.
Yes, the way they turn on their sister was something really look forward to.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, of course, this is a film by John Ford, who is a legendary director. There's just no other way to say it. What did you think of the look of this film? Because I think when I first watched it last year, actually, a lot like you, I watched it in trying to complete seeing the best pictures. I was actually really taken with how beautiful this film is.
Yeah, I think it looked really beautiful, especially because the way it progresses through the as the coal mine starts kind of taking up the whole valley. So that progression was actually something that struck quite a chord with me. Initially, it's actually very serene kind of a valley, and once the coal mine starts taking over, it gradually becomes dirtier and sort of things. It actually looks really beautiful, and I think that progression they caught up quite well.
Yeah, it's pretty impressive considering he was shooting all of this in a Hollywood backlot. Like you look at this, and it kind of looks like it's shot in a Welsh town, but it's California.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I know that it was shot in the backlot, but he did a really good job of that.
Yeah.
Production design, I guess. That's what he called it.
Yeah. Yeah, no, definitely.
It was beautiful.
So let's get down to the obvious question there. The specter hanging over this movie, of course, is that it was competing for Best Picture with Citizen Kane. With that in mind, what did you have going through your head, either like for it or against it, in comparing the two movies?
I don't want to compare. I don't want to.
No, come on. I know you got something.
I'm not the biggest fan of Citizen Kane itself.
Oh, see, now you're just done. Now,
exactly. That's what I didn't want to commit blasphemy on the very first podcast.
In that respect, you like this film more.
Yeah, but the thing is, I've seen Kane only once, and it was way back. I don't even remember anything except obvious question.
What's the sled, right?
Yeah, that's all I remember about Citizen Kane right now. But yes, I don't remember being completely taken away by Citizen Kane. This took some time for me to warm up to the film. Maybe it was 1941 kind of look of it, or the theatricality of 1941, or it was that voiceover narration. I'm not sure exactly what was it, but it took some time for me. By the end, I was completely into it, especially as I talked about the issue with his sister and the pastor, the priest. That was probably something which I thought the most fascinating aspect of the film was. And by the end, I don't think we're supposed to spoil the film, even after
it. It's a 70-year-old movie. Go ahead.
Yeah, so at the end, I was actually praying for their father to be well. So that was quite a progression. In the first 15 minutes, I was thinking that I'll just have to slog through it. Yeah. And by the end, I really cared for all the characters. So that was quite a good... quite a bit of feat for the film to achieve, I guess.
That is pretty impressive.
Yeah, that is actually. So I think this one was better, but Citizen Kane is a long due overwatch for me.
I guess kind of the spin that I would put on it then is that you're saying that it's a worthy winner. Like, as you're going through the Best Picture winners, you're noticing, I'm sure, that they're not all pearls.
Yes.
So,
yes, definitely.
But this is not one of those cases. This is actually a really, really worthy film that kind of gets smacked around a little bit because another film has its as its fans.
Yes, exactly. I think it was you and Steve who were Steve Hannibal. I mean, who quite well you can champion ordinary people, right?
Oh yeah.
Yeah, so I think this one, the one film that I thought of was Ordinary People in comparison to this, which it beat Raging Bull, right?
That's right.
Yeah, so it's not better than Raging Bull probably, but Ordinary People is not a bad film. So
no.
In the same way, I don't think How Green Was Mally is a bad film at all.
Yeah.
It's quite a worthy winner. Maybe not better than Citizen Kane, but that doesn't mean it's bad.
Certainly better than Gigi, that's what I say.
To mention Steve, he put up the list of all the films. He ranked, like you, I think, he ranked all the films, and out of last 10 films he has put, there are 8 that I haven't watched yet, so that's going to be a task.
yeah, it's kind of funny, because when I went through the same thing, I had to kind of map it out in my head. I was like, if I try to get through the best ones and leave the ones I think are worst to last, I'm not going to want to get through this. So I got to kind of, you got to play a balancing act. The one other thing that I really, really latched on to with How Green Is My Valley is my family comes from the East Coast of Canada, and the East Coast is all fishers and miners. And when you get a town that's a mining community like this Welsh village is, it's amazing how much terror can just ripple through the community just by the sound of an alarm at the mine.
Yeah.
And you see that all the time. You see that the world over when you have an industry that's manual labor and they sound out that alarm. And you see that in this movie too. And so that kind of thing. So I imagine that was kind of what really must have dug into you in the final act when we hear that whistle blowing and we know that there's been an accident at the mine.
Yeah, right. And it happens more than once.
Yep.
So yeah, you already know what's coming. Well, when the alarm sounds, you already know what's coming. You just don't want that to happen all the time.
Yeah, and especially when it's a family this big, you're thinking to yourself, okay, which one is it?
Yeah, and something similar has already happened before, so you kind of dread, no, please, that's what I was saying. I was actually praying for their father to be well in the end, because they already have lost one of their brothers in a similar accident. So
absolutely. So just to kind of wrap things up, coming away from How Green Was My Valley, was there anything that surprised you more than anything else, besides the fact of how much you ended up caring about it by the end? Was there any other thing about it that really surprised you?
I wouldn't say surprised me, but one thing that actually stood out for me is, apart from what we haven't talked about, was their mother character, the character of their mother.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, so sort of, I think there is a sentence in the film that he says that the father is kind of a brain of the family, but the mother is the heart of the family.
Right.
And I was actually pretty taken by how well that character was written, or how well the character was developed. I was actually pretty impressed by the whole, it's a big family, right? It's 5 brothers, 1 sister, plus one of the brother has a wife, plus the parents. There are too many characters. I was quite impressed by how well they handled all the side stories.
Yeah, there's a lot going on in this movie.
Yeah, exactly. In 2 hours, I was quite impressed by how much they put together in those 2 hours. So that was my final takeaway from the film, that it was actually quite well put together, whole film.
Good. Well, it sounds like your February blind spot was successful. If people want to read more of your work, where can they find you online?
At yumianfilmsblogspot.blogspot.com, and on Twitter at yumianfilms.
Very nice. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Okay, so now we're across a wire to Estonia, where we are talking to the brains behind Metal Ray, a site that I've been following for quite some time, and I'm really excited to finally be talking to this blogger. We're talking to Geta Trumsi from Estonia. How are you today?
Oh, I'm good. How are you?
I just woke up, so I'm not bad.
Gotta love the time difference, right?
Yeah, I think aside from talking to New Zealand, this is the earliest I've ever been up to do a podcast. But it's quite all right. It's, you know, the price I pay. Your blind spot this month might be one of the most widely beloved films of anybody's in a while. You watched The Princess Bride for the first time, the 1987 film by Rob Reiner. Did you have any kind of preconceptions of the film going in?
No, I just knew that many people loved it. I'd seen it in a list of, you know, my top 100 favorites and so on, and I didn't really know anything about it. Like, I assumed it was kind of like a fairy tale, mm-hmm. kind of inspired, but I absolutely no idea what I was walking into.
Okay. And how did it work out for you?
At first it was a bit odd, but then I got it. I got there at the end. I understood.
I see.
It was different. I expected something else.
Real? Okay. What did you expect?
I don't know. I was so looking forward to something really like serious or something, but okay. It wasn't. So I'm guessing I had a completely different idea of The Princess Bride.
It's like you expected you were going to be served dinner and somebody brought you dessert.
Exactly. Like, it was like, it kept getting funnier and I was like, what am I watching? and I think, yeah, it surprised me. I think those are the best kind of movies that eventually surprise you.
Yeah, of course. Now, one of the things I've always liked about the movie is the way it plays with the story within a story, the way it deals with, you know, the grandfather is telling the story, and how every once in a while it kind of jumps back and says, hey, wait, we heard that part already. What are you talking about? I guess you like that bit as well, right?
Yeah, I was also very, I liked the fact that the grandfather was telling the story to a boy rather than a girl, because I felt like that made a whole difference, like, to the whole fairy tale, like, understanding of, like, only girls like fairy tales, so
yeah,
I liked that part.
Yeah, I was thinking about that as well, because we're, you know, like, this year, for instance, we got Frozen in the movie theaters, and I don't know if you noticed or not, but the way they sold Frozen, it was sold very differently than how it actually played. Like, the posters and all the commercials, they tended to center around the snowman instead of around the sisters. And I don't know if it's because they think boys won't see fairy tales about princesses.
Well, that's an interesting question, because, yeah, because there wasn't much about the snowman.
Exactly.
In terms of, but yeah, I didn't notice a lot of the commercials of Frozen, though.
Oh, okay.
Just because they don't have a lot in the cinema here.
Oh, I see. But yeah, so in, you know, Princess Bride, we play with that very question as well, as, you know, whether or not a boy wants to hear a story of true love between
no kissing, no kissing.
No kissing. Don't tell me that part.
Yeah.
Now, I have to ask, are you watching House of Cards at all?
Yeah.
So how strange then was it to see Claire Underwood as this virtuous princess? Very, very young princess in this story.
Yeah, wasn't it like her first kind of movie role as well? Like,
pretty much, yeah.
Yeah, she hadn't done anything like that big before, so. So I didn't actually recognize her at first.
So it took, like, you're watching it and you're like, where do I know this person from?
Yeah, with a lot of the characters. Like, for instance, one of the characters was Potemkin something.
Oh, Mandy Potemkin.
Mandy?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I was like, how do I know him? And it was like, oh, Criminal Minds, yes, Homeland, woohoo! Yeah, and he looks so weird.
And as well, and he looks very different in this movie too, of course. Because, well, first of all, he's wearing that ridiculous long wig.
Oh, yeah.
But also, you know, he's much more spry in this than he is on certainly on Homeland and everything now. It's funny because there's a lot of people in this movie who they turn up and you're like, oh, hey, it's you. You know, like Christopher Guest, even. He's the six-fingered man.
Well, yeah, I did just the fact that with these kind of movies that you go back to, sometimes I find them funny because of the fact that you know those people now and you're thinking they would never play that role again.
That's
yeah. Like, he would never wear that wig, or like, he doesn't look like that man like now. So it's very funny. It adds to the character, I feel like.
Yeah.
So I think like some of the funny parts were actually funny because I know the actor now,
right?
In a whole new level. So
yeah, yeah, no, totally. That would totally change it. But sorry, so was it at all weird to watch Claire Underwood being all sweet and virtuous?
Yeah, I was kind of hoping that she was lying about something or trying to get the money or something, but yeah. No, she was very nice.
Yes, she was. The other thing I was going to bring up was that this movie, it's one of these stories where it didn't actually do all that well at the box office. Like it did okay, but it didn't exactly set the world on fire. So this is actually one that became a hit on home video, and I've always loved the way that film can do that sometimes, how a film can come out and not really make much of an impact when it's in the theater, but then as people like us watch it and tell our friends about it, and it gains this word of mouth, it gains this whole second life.
Yeah, it's nice though. Those kind of movies also can gain a second life after, like, I don't know, 20 years or so. So it's very... It's more than 20 years. How old is the movie now?
Almost 30 years. It was 1987, yeah. So more than 25 years now. Yeah. And of course, like this became a word of mouth hit like before the age of the internet, really. So films now have an even better chance,
yeah,
of latching on when people like you or I are talking about them and tweeting about them and tumbling about them. You know, they
yeah, exactly. Certainly. Like, some movies even get made thanks to the fans, yeah. Like Veronica Mars movie coming out soon. So
exactly.
I mean, so it's a nice thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Was there anything else about the movie that that jumped out at you?
I don't know. I don't know if it was on purpose. Some of the things were kind of ironic for me.
Like what?
Like falling down the mountain scene. Oh, God. I had to watch it twice just to understand. Like it was seriously like thinking like they were kind of making fun of these kind of action movies or something, because it was the rat fight and so on. It was very ironic for me. I don't know. Maybe it was just... the fact that it was the 80s and now it's totally different, but
yeah, there is, it's kind of funny because there is a small 80s sensibility to it that, like, if it were, yeah, to be made today, they either might play it a little bit more comedic or more earnest.
Yeah, it's exactly, it was kind of like intertwined with like serious action and then there's some comedy and yeah, it was a really nice movie. I was very surprised in the beginning. I kind of didn't begin to impress me in the beginning, rather more in the end.
That's crazy. You're the second person this episode to say that they started watching the film and it wasn't doing much at the beginning. Now, I do need to ask, because for people of my generation, this movie is pretty much unassailable. Like, you know, it's the kind of movie that you know, you don't dare speak ill of it. But I always like to ask people who didn't grow up with it and who watch it for the first time, was there anything about it that you didn't like? Because I imagine it might have some flaws that people just look past.
Well, it depends. Like, I'm so used to seeing like these older movies and seeing the things that they had like on that time.
Uh-huh.
They were like normal. But for me, you know, the kind of, I don't know, maybe the story played like too back and forth all the time with these characters coming together in the beginning already, which was weird. But then again, it was also cool because you're so used to the romantic kind of things happening in the end. But these were the two people who came together in the beginning already.
Okay.
And then
okay.
They were taken apart. But that's just the movie. So it isn't bad, but it's something that I wasn't used to. I think that's why I didn't like it in the beginning. I was like, where's the mystery now? They're together. Woohoo, yay. but then, you know, the movie kind of picked up and yeah, okay. I wouldn't say, I don't dare to say anything bad about cult favorites and things. That's why I don't rate my movies that I watch, kind of like...
That's a good attitude to have.
Yeah.
So I guess maybe actually that's one of the things that works in this film's favor, is that for an 80s movie, it really doesn't feel all that 80s.
Yeah.
You know, if you watch this back to back with Ferris Bueller or The Breakfast Club, this would seem like it's off on its own island.
Yeah, it's very, very different. Yeah, I've also seen the both movies. So I saw Ferris Bueller for last month.
That's right. That's right. You did.
Yeah.
So just to wrap things up, was there anything about The Princess Bride that especially surprised you, that you didn't really expect, that, you know, you kind of take away with a little bit of shock or a little bit of happy surprise?
Mandy.
Ah.
He surprised me. he was very handsome in his wig.
Well, and he's got his very, you know, proper manner of speaking, and
yeah, and a whole cool different storyline, and he almost died then he didn't, and he fought through, and now he's on Homeland, so good for him.
Yeah, I think I'm gonna have to watch some episodes of Homeland today after all this conversation.
Yeah, sorry.
No, it's quite all right. I'll pepper it in with House of Cards. It'll make a great little double feature after,
oh yeah,
after
that,
watching
that would be cool.
Princess Bride. So where can people read your work online if they want to look for more of your stuff?
Metalray.wordpress.com.
And on Twitter?
On Twitter, it's also Metalray.
There we go. Well, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. That's my first podcast, so thank you.
You need to do more of these. You have a great voice for this.
Oh, thanks.
All right, so now we're across the wire to southern England, where we're talking to the owner and proprietor of LifeVersusFilm.com. Jay Cluett is with us. How are you, Jay?
Very well, thank you, Ryan. And yourself?
Not bad, not bad. How's the Blind Spots been treating you so far?
Very well, very well. Only my second one.
Good.
I'm enjoying it so far.
I'm hoping to get people addicted one person at a time.
You've got me hooked.
Nice. You went back to 1975 and chose a film I wouldn't have suggested, so I'm going to be kind of interested to see how this works out for you. You went to the freaky, kooky guests of Dr. Frank and Furter and watched the Rocky Horror Picture Show. Before we get into what you actually thought of the film, did you have any preconceptions of the film coming in?
I thought I was going to hate it. Basically, the only reason I picked it, the focus of my site is the 1001 movies you must see before you die list, and Rocky Horror Picture Show is on there. And I really didn't think I was going to like it, because I'm not the biggest fan of musicals. I'm even less of a fan of dancing in films, and nudity kind of I find off-putting in musicals, and transvesticism.
Okay.
No offense to anyone who's into that kind of thing. It's not my cup of tea, shall we say. And I was aware that this had an awful lot of all of that. So I was fully expecting to hate every aspect of it.
So you were forewarned, I see. And how did it turn out?
I absolutely loved it.
Really?
Yes, I thoroughly enjoyed the entire experience.
Okay. that's kind of crazy, because Rocky Horror Picture Show, it's actually, it's a cult film, really. It's not the kind of thing that I think is everybody's bag, really. But it's grown in popularity through the years just because of this kind of fan culture around it. And it actually holds the record as the longest running film.
Yes, it's Sigourney in Munich for 27 years, I think.
Well, not only that, but like every, you know, you go into any major city and you can find a screening of it, you know, usually every other Friday.
Yes, that's what you mean, yeah.
Right. So, but it's, like you said, it's kind of twisted. It's not exactly trying to play things straight up. Like, it wears its loyalties on its sleeve. It's very much a B-movie, which you can kind of tell from, you know, the sort of movies that it's kind of winking at throughout. It sort of seems like this kind of thing that would be playing very late on TV.
Yeah, the sets are pretty terrible, and the lip syncing isn't there's not a lot of money being put into it.
But even like, I'm even thinking of like, you know, the way that Riff Raff speaks and the fact of where, like where the story, certainly where the story ultimately goes and this giant haunted castle, it kind of, it seems like the sort of thing that you would see, introduced by Vincent Price.
Yeah, so actually I caught it. It was 5 to midnight when it was exactly. on. So I didn't really I could see it was by recording it.
Yeah,
so,
exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Now, the one thing I'm not surprised that you loved is there is some amazing music in this movie.
There is. Of course, I'd heard Time Warp before because you can't escape that if you've ever been to a disco or a wedding.
Right.
But I just loved pretty much all of the songs. The meatloaf scene with Hot Patootie, I think, is probably my favorite song in the entire thing because I'm a bit of a meatloaf fan. I wasn't even aware he was in it.
So. Yeah, and he shows up with a vengeance.
Yes, he does.
Have you been able to get the music out of your head for the last few weeks?
I haven't been trying to because I've been listening to it since. I've been on Spotify. I've been listening to it now and then. I'm very tempted to go out and buy it. But, yeah,
it's great stuff for sure. The thing I always love is that you know the gloriously trashy glam 80s rockers Twisted Sister, they're the house band.
Yes, they are.
Yeah,
that's right. I didn't realize that. Yes.
Yeah, I have a copy. Somebody got me a vinyl copy of the soundtrack, and that's how I found out. I was looking at the back of it. I was like, oh, look at that. Now, of course, the other thing that goes along with Rocky Horror is that, like we mentioned, the screenings that still take place to this day, they're rather interactive. I don't suppose you got in on any of that, did you?
No, because I watched this just myself and my partner at home.
Oh, okay.
She wasn't really as into it as I was. So.
See, I told you it's not for everybody.
Yeah, she thought it was very strange.
That's actually the thing that if I had have known longer beforehand, like in your part of the country, do they do showings of it at all?
Not that I know of. It's not as big of a thing over here as it is, I'm assuming, in the States and in Canada.
Yeah,
Maybe in London, if anywhere, they might have some screenings, but certainly not anywhere near me.
Yeah, because it's kind of crazy because you go to these showings and the movie is almost secondary. There's usually people who are dressed up as the characters down in front of the stage, kind of lip syncing along with it and doing some of the moves. And there's cues for you to do certain specific things. So like during the wedding at the beginning, people are supposed to throw rice around. When later on, I think it's the doctor makes a toast, you actually end up throwing pieces of toast.
Of course, why not?
Oh yeah. And there's like callback lines that you're supposed to yell at the screen. So when Brad and Janet first arrive at the doctor's door, you know, he says, "Hi, I'm Brad Majors," and everybody's supposed to yell, "Asshole." And this is my wife, and there's a pause too. Like there's a long enough pause that you can do it without interrupting anything, and then he goes, "And this is my wife, Janet Weiss," and you're supposed to yell "slut," and the whole crowd gets into it. It's probably like no other movie. It's this movie that's created its own animal all its own.
I've kind of been advised not to go to these.
Why?
Well, I've been advised to go to them, but also not to go because I haven't been before. There's a kind of a hazing ritual if you've not been to one. So if I do go, I shouldn't admit that it's my first time.
It's a very gentle hazing, I promise.
Okay.
Now, the funny thing is that on a surface level, I'm actually kind of surprised you like it because the movie's not that good, specifically in its second half. Like I don't know if you felt this, but for me it's always taken a dive after the touch me number.
I would say as soon as meatloaf scene ends, it
really
kind of goes a bit off the rails.
Oh, okay. Well,
that's where I lost it.
Putting but, it mildly. But
well, it kind of starts to decline. You have got the touch me scene after that, I think.
But you did notice that it's
the final third is insane.
And yeah,
for a film with as much insanity this already has in it, that's saying something.
It's almost like it just runs out of road.
Definitely very much so.
Which, you know, it is kind of crazy. It's you know, you'll hear every once in a while when people are talking about musicals, both like stage musicals and film musicals, you'll hear second act problems.
Yes.
You know, where people would just either like leave at intermission if it was a live show or if it was a movie. You know, the back when we were using videotapes and movies came on two tapes, they just wouldn't play tape two.
Right.
You know, Rocky Horror kind of suffers from that. Like there's a lot that happens in the back half.
I can see that. Yeah.
Yeah. Was there anything else that like jumped out at you watching this for the first time?
Well, something that I really loved about it was the performances, specifically Tim Curry and Richard O'Brien. Now, Richard O'Brien, I don't know if you have the Crystal Maze in Canada.
We probably do, but I haven't.
Okay. It's an early 90s British game show.
Okay.
And it Richard O'Brien hosts it. It involves going to different kind of zones and doing little puzzle games for crystals. Which
we'll
get the time later on. And I only ever knew him from that before. So seeing him as Riff Raff in Rocky Horror is something of a departure. But he is so much fun in this film. He's just brilliant. I loved every aspect of his character. And Tim Curry is, I think this was his first film role. I mean, he'd done stage work before, including Frankenfurter on stage. But if this is the start of your film career, that is very impressive.
Well, and the crazy thing about that, too, is that he was able to outrun it, right? Like if you sometimes when you do something like this as your first role, it's all you ever get cast as. You always get cast as the freak.
Yes.
But he, you know, yeah, he, like, don't get me wrong, he was always playing somebody much larger than life throughout his career, and still is. I don't know why I'm talking about him in the past tense, he certainly was able to wear a role this freakish and then still get some work. I'm still trying to bend my brain around Richard O'Brien, though, if I sound distracted, just because I can't imagine going into a movie that somebody you know as a game show host and seeing them as Riff Raff.
He's a very odd kind of game show host.
Oh, okay.
He's very kind of intense, shall we say.
That's cool.
He's not your typical like asking questions. It's more running around giving orders kind of.
Oh, okay.
But if you ever get a chance to catch Crystal Mason,
I'll be watching it this afternoon. I promise you.
Brilliant. But Tim Curry, he's so captivating.
Yes.
Like you can't take your eyes off him. He does a lot of his stuff is direct to screen as well, like as though he's on a stage singing to an audience.
Yes.
And that just kind of adds to it, I think.
Oh, of course. Yeah. And it's kind of funny because it becomes he's become like the embodiment of the role, right? Like if anytime somebody tries to do this on stage, for instance, like stage productions of this do pop up from time to time. I've seen one here in Toronto. And anytime somebody tries to do it on stage, in the back of your brain, you're always thinking, okay, are you going to be better than Tim Curry?
No, they're not. Yeah.
Of course not. No,
I imagine they're trying to do a Tim Curry impersonation.
Yep, that's what they do. So just to kind of close things off, given you know your preconceptions and I'd say in some respects your hesitations towards this movie, was there anything that surprised you coming away from it?
Well, I was surprised that I liked it, for one thing.
Sure.
But I'm probably going to go back to see it again, but just the direction it took towards the end where it became more science fiction-y, and I think it turns out they're all aliens. Slight spoiler alert.
I don't think it's possible to spoil this movie at this point.
I wasn't fully prepared for that, but yeah, I was just very surprised that I liked it at all, really.
Yeah,
it was I thought I was going to watch it as an endurance kind of challenge.
But I got to be honest, I thought you were too. when I saw the list of what you were going to watch, I was like, okay, good luck. Because I do know one of the participants in the series last year, they did all cult movies, and sometimes I think cult movies are cult movies for a reason, that just on a surface level, they're not great. And if you're not in the right mindset when you sit down to watch them, you're in for a long road. And in some respects, I would say that Rocky Horror is part of that, especially like, as you're saying, if you're not crazy about musicals, then, you know, Lord knows of all the musicals I could tell you to try and watch to get you into them, this is not going to be one of the first five. So being surprised that you liked it that much, that's I'll take that for sure.
It was just a lot of fun, really.
Yeah, it was. And as I said, if you ever get the chance to go to one of these interactive screenings, you know, bring your toast, bring your rice, and buckle up because it's a great time. Jay, where can people find you online?
Lifeversusfilm.com. I also host the Lambcast, which is large-assmovieblogs.com, or find it on iTunes.
Cool. And if people want to look for you on Twitter, are you there?
At lifeversusfilm, LIFEVSFILM.
Thank you for joining us, sir.
My pleasure.
We're across the wire now to the United States of America, specifically Texas, right?
Yes.
There we go. We are talking to somebody I'm kind of excited to talk to because usually this show is all about movie bloggers, and we just got somebody who's just has a passion for writing, and movies just happens to be one of the things she writes about. Her site is perspectiveofawriter.wordpress.com. Danny Idy is here. How are you tonight?
I'm good. I'm really good. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for agreeing to a random request from some guy whose site you don't really read to say come on by.
Oh, no, I read.
Oh, good.
I don't always comment, you know, unless I have something I want to say. But that's fine. I read a lot of people. So.
Oh, good. Okay. I feel better now. And so your selection for The Blind Spot was actually kind of fun for me because of all the movies I've talked about and will talk about on this episode, yours is the first one that I hadn't seen either. It was a blind spot for myself as well. You went back to 1985 and you chose a Swedish film by Lasse Hallström called My Life as a Dog, which I get the feeling a lot of my listeners might not have seen. So why don't you tell them a little bit about what it's about?
It's about this boy named Ingemar, and he's 12 years old, and his mother's ill, and he has a little brother, but his dad's not in the picture, and so basically he's being shuffled around. And the way he sees it is that his life is like that of a dog's.
Yeah, yeah, which is, you know, that there's your title right there. Now, I've been starting with everybody asking them if they had any preconceptions when they put their blind spot list together. Did you have any kind of expectations or preconceptions coming into My Life as a Dog?
Well, I love subtitled films. Okay. That's kind of weird. So I really was looking forward to getting like the Swedish kind of perspective because, you know, I knew going in that it was subtitled, and so I was hoping to really get a little bit of their culture besides getting a really good story.
Okay, okay. And now, obviously, now that I've seen it, I guess you certainly did get that because it's the one thing I like about Swedish films, I've kind of gotten into them more in the last 5 years or so. I think before that, I could probably count the number of Swedish films I'd seen on one hand. They're very subtle.
Yes, this was very subtle. In fact, when I came out of it, I was like, whoa, you know, what did I get from that? You know, and I had to think about it a little bit.
Yeah. And which, you know, for some people, that doesn't really work well for them. But for me, I really like that. I kind of like that it's more, there's more texture to it. A lot of them feel more human. You know, of course, if we're not talking about movies like Let the Right One In, where we're dealing with Swedish vampires as well. But as far as the story goes, the one thing I found myself drawn to is, you know that old saying, it takes a village to raise a child?
Yeah.
That's sort of really very much in play here, right?
Yes, yes. He used very normal coming of age kind of symbols, but I kind of felt like, you know, even though it made me think at the end, I liked some of the events he had happen along the way. So like you could enjoy the film and come out and go, that was good. But then I was like, you know, I kind of like seek a deeper meaning and things. So I was just like, it still made me think. And that's what I really enjoyed. But I thought, because what I tend to do when I review something is I go and I read some of what other people say.
Okay.
And one reviewer, I think it's the LA Times, he said he just thought it was so typical. And I was thinking about that for a long time because there was typical symbols, like you said, the village to raise a child. But at the same token, I think he did it in a really creative way.
He did, like, you know, everything down from the way, you know, the dynamics of at the house that he's staying at. We see this house that he gets taken into, and he basically, the Ingmar is at first brought to this town to stay for a while. He's taken back home for a while, and then he's shuttled back to the town after a few months. And in that time, things have changed even at the house he was staying, and you see how that affects him, right? Like, he doesn't. Not even having the run of this foster house anymore really screws him up.
Yeah, it really does. This reviewer had said that he felt it was kind of talking to adults. Like, mm-hmm. it was like the too smart, you know? Huh. And I felt like, no, this is what kind of like what a snapshot of life is. I mean, he went away and he came back and things were different and he had pressures on him that, you know, were added to the pressure he had from his mother dying.
Yeah.
You know, and he didn't really know exactly what to do about it.
Yeah. You know, it's children are more complicated than we think. And you kind of get the impression that if we paid more attention to children sometimes, instead of getting wrapped up in our own shit, that we'd notice this kind of thing. You mentioned earlier that it's a coming of age story. And some podcasters that I listen to quite a bit brought up an interesting point on their show last week, where they mentioned that when it comes to coming of age stories, you tend to see them more around boys. And not as much around girls. And I have you ever noticed that, or do you have any idea why that might be?
I don't really know. The first coming of age story I ever read was in a book, and it was about a girl who was abandoned and like in the middle of this kind of Holocaust situation. So to me, I didn't notice that pattern.
Okay.
I do agree though, the proponent of them are aimed toward boys. And I was thinking about all the coming of age stories that, you know, I could recall just off of the top of my head without thinking about it too hard. And like, you know, you think about like Goonies, you know, yeah. That's kind of a coming of age, you know, American coming of age story.
Yeah.
And it's about, you know, mainly a boy. And the thing I thought was interesting is it was really all his own peers. He didn't really interact too much with adults in that one.
No.
So that was more the pattern I picked up on rather than on, you know, the sex of the character.
That's one of those things I might dig into later, is to try and find a few more. I think you're right, though. I think it comes up in books a little bit more than it comes up on film.
Yeah, I think, but you think about it, you know, I think movies are, you know, film is a male, that's a male draw, you know.
Well, it's a male-dominated medium, right?
Yeah.
So that actually probably, there's your answer. This film is directed by Laza Hallström. This is back when he was still primarily working in Sweden, before he came to America. And as I was watching this film, I had to wonder to myself, what the heck ever happened to Laza Hallström? Because I don't know if you've noticed or not, but he is not making this kind of movie anymore. He has made like some... He has made some like Nicholas Sparks adaptations. He made Chocolat. He made, he's just made some, I'm going to say it. He's made some crap in the last 10 years. And it's one of those things where I wonder if some of these international directors are better staying out of Hollywood because Hollywood's just not going to do the right things for them.
Yeah. I was looking at that too. Like, I think in 2014, he has a new project and I was like, you're doing that? I mean, after you've done some pretty, I thought this film was pretty incredible. So
yeah,
I think the thing I've learned, you know, I have some other interests outside of American, you know, movies and stuff. So I kind of have a little bit more other perspectives about it. Sometimes Americanized things, you know, not to insult my own people, but, you know, they
go ahead. It's all right.
Dumb down
show.
A little bit some things, you know, and I think sometimes they can strip away some of the beauty of the international. So it's very interesting to see which directors maintain that, you know.
And so few of them do.
Right. And he, unfortunately, is one of the ones that seem to have been more and more Americanized.
Well, the crazy thing, too, is, you know, when he first got over to America, like not long after, one of his first films is What's Eating Gilbert Grape. And I see a lot of that movie in this movie.
Yes, very much so.
So I don't know if maybe he just kind of fell off the wagon after that, or they thought, no, we want you to make some stuff that's just a little bit sunnier. You know, maybe Lasse should go back to making Swedish films, and you know, we'll get a little bit more out of it. Well, I've been ending these segments with asking people with their preconceptions in mind and selecting their films for the blind spot, if there was anything about the film that surprised them. So when you got to the end of My Life as a Dog, was there anything that kind of surprised you more than anything else?
Well, coming of age stories tend to be a snapshot of life, and so I was really shocked by how much that last final shot stuck with me. Like, I could not escape that shot. Just it's Ingmar and Saga, his little girlfriend kind of that he had made, is just curled up together and they're listening to this fight and, you know, asleep. And I just felt like I could see the future for them and I could see this future for, you know, Ingmar and the kind of man he might become. And so I was really just shocked how he could do that with just like one image, you know.
Yeah.
And there wasn't really any dialogue, there wasn't any voiceover, you know, like you would tend to see maybe in an American movie.
Yeah.
And it was just shockingly beautiful, just a beautiful way to end it.
Yeah.
And I felt like I got more out of it than just that segment of his life.
I think, and that's the thing for me, is to like kind of to answer my own question, given that this is the only film of the six we're talking about on this show that I hadn't seen before, is just a huge amount of elegance in what is like a very simple visual film. Like, it's not doing anything overly tricky, but it just, everything in it is just so rich and so wonderfully shot. I think that was my biggest surprise, was just how splendid this film looks.
Yes, and I think they derived the things from the book it was based on. They pulled out the sweetest, best moments, you know, very quirky moments to portray, you know, the arc of the story. And yeah. I mean, just so well chosen. Of course, you don't want to talk about it because it would ruin it for others. But
No, of course. I do hope that people do chase this film down. There's a really great Criterion version of it out there. And, you know, it played really well for both Danny and myself, who neither one of us had seen it before. Danny, if people want to read more of your stuff online, where can they find you?
PerspectiveOfAWriter.wordpress.com.
And are you on Twitter very much?
I am about a couple of times a week.
Oh, okay. So if people want to follow you, where can they find you there?
At Yay Kiss Purr.
Thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
We're back in Canada. We're back in Casa del McNeil, actually, back in Toronto, to talk to the brains behind Amiresque. That's at amiresque.blogspot.com. Amir Sultani's here. How are you, sir?
I'm very good.
I'm holding up your dinner. I feel bad.
No, it's okay. I'm just a little bit nervous. It's the first time I'm recording my voice.
Oh, no. You know what? You're not the only one. There's several first-timers in this show.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. This is I'm getting a lot of people in on one party. This is great.
Yeah, last time I heard my voice recorded, it was on a voicemail I'd left for someone.
And it's trippy, isn't it?
When I heard it, I hated it so much. I thought I'm never going to record my voice.
And now here you are.
And I've never left anyone a voicemail after that.
So. You'll think you're like, screw it, I'm hanging up. You, your blind spot this month, which might even be posted by the time this show goes up, you watched a French film directed by Agnès Varda. You watched Cleo from 5 to 7.
Yes.
Now, did you have any preconceptions going into the film?
A bit, yeah. I am.
Or any expectations? Like, did it come with baggage?
A little bit, yeah. I put it on. I think in my intro post to my schedule for this year's series, I wrote down that first of all, I really enjoyed Varda's Gleaners and I, and also Happiness, the only two films by her that I've seen prior to this. But also, I wrote that I'm picking this film because Kiva Reardon's journal is now called Cleo Journal, and I read it every month.
Oh, that's why.
And it's
why.
Named after
oh,
this.
Okay.
And I thought, okay, canonical feminist film. It's kind of bad that I've never seen it. I like the director's other films, so might as well.
Okay.
So it was actually slated for April until.
So it came with some lofty heights. And
yes.
Okay, so how did it work out for you?
It totally met them.
Really?
I loved it. I loved it on every single level. And I have a suspicion you didn't as much.
No. You know what? This was one I heard about it. I did not put together two and two on that one and understand that it was how Kiva had named her journal. I heard about it on Film Spotting SVU. They were talking about it. I think it was streaming for the first time like 4 or 5 months ago. And I just kind of made a note. I listened to the conversation, which is weird because usually if I haven't seen a film,
I usually skip that part of a podcast or a review or something like that, right?
So do I, actually.
And yet I'm expecting people to listen to my own stuff when they haven't seen. But I listened to it, and I got, like, doses of what it was about. And I was like, okay, that sounds kind of interesting. I'm going to keep that in mind to watch. And it came up on TCM, actually. I looked through their schedule every month to see, like, what they're bringing that I haven't seen. So I recorded it, and just without preconception, really, aside from what I'd heard on Film Spotting, and I just let it play. I think I'd even kind of forgotten what it was about. I knew certain things about it, and I remembered certain touches that they were talking about, but I'd forgotten. No. I loved this movie. I was surprised at how much I loved this movie. It was fantastic.
So that's actually, that brings up a good question, because you didn't know it had that feminist baggage, let's call it. So did it strike you as that, though? Did you feel like it was?
You know what? Not until you pointed it out in your email, actually. I hadn't thought of it in that capacity. Okay. And I don't know what that says about me, or what that says about the film. As soon as you mentioned it, I began to think about that. I was thinking about it more from a humanist perspective. I was thinking about it more in terms of mortality. But and we'll get back there. But yeah, as soon as you said, you know, huge beacon in feminist culture, I was like, yeah, okay, I'm understanding that now. But I hadn't approached it, and I hadn't really come away from it with that. Did you, or I guess you went in
a little bit, but I'm a little bit self-conscious not talking about feminism, given that we're. No,
I'm self-conscious podcasting. Talking about a lot of things. Like, I gotta be honest, like, when this month, my blind spot this month was Shaft, and I'm self-conscious talking about race. Not in a way that I think I'm gonna say something dumb, but just in a way I think that so many other people have already said dumb things that it's just really, really tainted the conversation. Same thing with feminism. Too many men have said too many idiotic things that I feel like I'm, like, this close to being that guy. And
you never
want to
be that guy.
Yeah, I want to understand. We should tell people what this is about, because I kind of get the feeling that people haven't seen it. You tell them, because I've been talking a lot.
Alrighty. It's about a woman, a young singer, who's, I think, only had 3 songs out, actually, and is trying to promote her own music. Everywhere she goes, to the point where she plays her songs in a cafe on the jukebox. The film is very clearly demarcated in terms of its timing. You see it on the screen, the actual passage of time. It shows
it's
up.
It's like 15-minute blocks, isn't it? Or 10-minute blocks.
I think they change.
Yeah.
There's like 4-minute ones or 10-minute ones.
Yeah.
The longest one, I think, is a 15-minute block. Mm-hmm. I believe that's the last one. Technically, the title of the film should be Cleo from 5 to 6:30, because it's exactly 90 minutes. And Cleo basically is waiting medical test results to confirm if she has terminal cancer or not. We open the film with a card reader, a fortune teller, telling her what's going to happen, which is not good news, and she believes it, in the opening scene. And for the rest of the film, she kind of walks around the streets of Paris and talks to her maid/assistant, and goes to clothing stores, talks to friends, meets people, random, some of them not, her songwriters. She practices her music with them at her apartment until the hour and a half passes, and she gets to find out what the doctor has to say.
Now, the crazy thing about this, the first thing that jumped out at me is, and this is where I talk about it from a humanist perspective, is how we all deal with stress and life-changing events so very differently, okay? I know people who their parents were in the hospital, and they were just going to work and just burying themselves in work. I know people who they get the slightest hint of bad news, and they shut down, like nothing happens, right? Their apartment just goes to crap, they stop eating, all they can do is think. And that was the first thing I gravitated towards in Cleo, is she opens up. When this movie opens up and we hear that she's got the news that she might have terminal cancer, she does everything to distract herself in 90 minutes. Like, I don't think ever jammed more into 90 minutes of my life than Cleo does in these 90 minutes. And that's not to say that it's implausible, because it's in real time. You can see how she gets from A to B to A to B, and she is walking through some of it. There's not a whole lot of cuts that really leave a gap.
but pretty much all real time.
Yeah, yeah. But that's the thing. If I got news like this, like if I, you know, if doctor said, hey, we felt something. Now, I don't know that I'm going to sit there and stare at the phone, but I'm not going to go try on clothes, and I'm not going to go hang with my friends. I might find like one friend and go for lunch or something. But that was the thing for me, was what this woman does with her time and what we all do with our time in this kind of thing.
I totally agree with you. And I think the most interesting thing in my review, I will mention this, or I have mentioned it, depending on when it goes up, that I think the most interesting thing Varda does with the film is actually put those time, the passage of time on the screen to make you aware of that, because it sort of serves contradictory purposes as...
How so?
In that it makes you feel Cleo's restlessness and her nervousness more, because you sense that time is running out for her, metaphorically, because obviously she's not going to die at the end of the 90 minutes. She's just going to get the test results back, yeah, right? But she instills that sense that, you know, her time is running out. This is all she has time for. So she's doing this and then doing that, and she has to cram everything in her last hour and a half. But also it does something else, in that because we are accustomed to seeing films where, because of elliptical editing, you sort of see time differently. Mm-hmm. Here, it kind of paradoxically drags them out. Like, you see her maid talking in the cafe with a stranger about whatever it is, I forget now, and you kind of feel like time is running out for her. And the film kind of drags that conversation out, and it's like, Cleo doesn't have that much more time. You kind of want her to move on, but she's sitting there listening to that conversation. So
it's like the film is checking its own watch.
Exactly.
You know, like exactly. For better and for worse, and especially with those intercards, it's like every once in a while the film's just looking at its wrist and saying, you know, crap, I got to be somewhere for the doctor, or hell, you know, how much more time have I passed? Oh, only 4 minutes? Shit. You know, I really want to get to 7 o'clock. Now, the one other thing, of course, with the, you know, with the angle of this as a very, very feminist touchstone, is within the span of this afternoon, this evening, I should say, she interacts with a lot of men, and they're in various capacities, like, you know, whether it's the doctor who she talks to on the phone, or her friends that are playing the piano in that beautiful salon that she goes to. Like, she goes to this. I want to live in Paris. If only for the apartments.
Doesn't everybody?
If only for the apartments. I'm sure that there are dive, crappy little rent-controlled places in Paris that are hell to live in. I've never seen one in a movie.
And you can't miss them in movies either. Like, no. You see Amour, and it's the saddest apartment in the world, but...
It's so beautiful. Yeah, yeah, like, yeah. Windows that open. I mean, come on. But she goes...
Pigeons come in.
Right.
Real life.
She goes to this apartment, and she's hanging out with these men. They're the musicians, and they're playing her songs, and they're writing songs for her. And then later, of course, she goes and she hangs out with a complete stranger, this man who she meets in a garden. And I thought that, like, that as soon as you said that, watching her interact with these men, and she seems to be slightly different every time. And that's obviously true of anybody. But certainly with everything that she has on her mind, it's really, really fascinating to watch how she interacts with these guys.
Yeah, it's true. To your point, something that really stuck out to me, sort of, was how Varda shapes our perception of her through these interactions. Not even specifically with the people she talks with in person, her friends, but even people she meets on the street. So, you know, especially this was really striking, I think, in the scenes where she's just passing by stores on the street, and you see men and women, actually, maybe not coincidentally, I think, just looking at her with judging looks. Some people recognize her, some men catcall, some men look at her behind as she walks by. Yeah. Some women judge her for whatever it is, some men judge her for whatever it is. But you never get the sense that, as a man, no matter how many times women talk about this, you kind of don't feel that lived reality of how pervasive it is to go on the street and be looked
judged.
At
yeah.
and be judged
yeah.
and be called things constantly, right? And I think what this film does is that it doesn't just show it, but it juxtaposes that with a performer who's piercing his own arm and a performer who's like eating frogs or whatever, and everybody is equally pervasive and intent on watching that person. And as Cleo walks away from that, you get the sense that she's dealing with the same thing on a constant basis, day in and day out. Like, a scene after you saw that, you see her walking away, and exactly the same number of people are looking at her.
It's probably even worse, because with so much on her mind, she's probably hyper-aware as well.
Exactly.
You know, yeah. like she's it's probably one of these moments where, like, she is extremely composed in this movie. Lord knows I would not be that composed if I was killing 2 hours in between doctor's calls. But she, inside, I'm sure she's just a mess, and every little glance, she's like, do they know? Do they know? You know, and they put that all over this film. Now, of course, the one thing we got to get to is, so it's called Cleo from 5 to 7. She's going to get the call about the news at 7 o'clock. But this film, pardon the pun, has the balls to stop at 6:30. Did you know that was coming? Did you know that it wasn't going to get to 7?
No.
Okay, so how did...
Well, I mean, given that, you know, 50% through the film,
but that's
just,
okay,
I
but you put it together midway.
Yeah.
Okay. So when we got to 6:30 and we didn't get our answer of what's up with Cleo, like how did
spoiler alert?
Well, yeah, I was gonna say.
Although this film
well,
is
no,
about
it's
50
an
something.
Spoiler. We don't know, right? How did that play? For you? Cutting it off by 30 minutes. Like, is that a master stroke? Is that frustrating? Is that make it that much more special? Because I feel like that would play different for everybody.
I thought it was kind of a masterstroke, actually, as you put it. I'm curious, actually, how did the play? Is there a specific reason you're asking?
Because I didn't know. I found that out when I was watching it on Turner Classics. I found it out because Robert Osborne mentioned it in his introduction,
okay. And
he said, and it was kind of the antithesis of when I watched A Man Escaped, and the person introducing it said that the man escapes, because in that point I was like, son of a bitch, you just ruined that shit for me. But here they said it cuts off at 6:30, and I was like, oh crap, okay, so what happens at 6:30? So I was even more intrigued, right, by telling me that I'm not going to get to 7. It set me that way. Now if I was like you and I just kind of started watching it, or I looked at the time code and I put it together in my head, I don't know how that would have worked, but I loved it. I love that we don't get to 7.
Yeah, and I think, would it have been more anticlimactic if we got to 7 with the same ending? Probably not. I think the fact that she leaves the... Because in the end, we don't find out what happens to her. But if
right.
we got to 7...
Which
she
we still might not have. Like, the
yeah.
film still could have cut to black at the call.
Yeah.
Right? I don't know. I guess, like, part of the reason why I think it's brilliant is I'm left here wondering what she did in that last 30 minutes. Right? Like, this is what she did in 90. What's she going to do in that last 30? That's where I'm certainly wondering. So, like, you know, we, like, this is a movie, I gotta be honest, like, of all the ones that everybody chose this month, and people chose some great blind spots this month, this is the film I could talk about for hours. So I'm actually kind of frustrated that I'm keeping these segments so short. But was there something about Cleo from 5 to 7, despite your preconceptions and despite what you already knew, was there anything that surprised you about it more than anything else?
More than anything, I think it surprised me about how confident it was, because I believe it's her first film. I don't want to...
Wait,
it's either a very early film, or yeah, it's either a very early film or it's her first film. I think
it's her second film.
Second film.
That is very early on, and that is very confident.
And you know, to start the film the way she does, with a color sequence, with the still camera showing you the cards and nothing else, and then moving on to this very cinema verite type of filmmaking, especially in the street sequences, which are, as I mentioned earlier, they kind of put you in her space. It looks so gritty and realistic. And then to those, I don't know if you noticed that scene in when she's practicing the song with her songwriters, where the camera starts to swing with the music.
Yeah, I loved it.
And all these stylistic touches for such a young director. In her first effort, I mean, you kind of expect when a film becomes this canonical to have that special thing about it, right?
Mm.
But still, it surprised me how accomplished and controlled it was in terms of her directing.
Definitely, this is gonna be. I think I can't. I'm pretty sure I watched it this year, and it will certainly be one of my favorite first watches of the year. So I'm definitely glad you got it out of the blind spot. I'd kind of be interested to hear what you and Kiva talk about when
oh, next time you see her. That's intimidating.
I don't doubt it. Where can people find your work online?
At the moment, I just started writing for Movie Mezzanine, which nice. You also write for.
Welcome. Yes, I kind of need to do a bit more of that.
I started writing with an article about Sundance, basically telling the reader not to read Sundance reviews, so that was kind of a not very nice article
that's
to start
fine.
With.
That's fine. No, that's fine.
And a couple of movie reviews, but mostly you can see me at The Film Experience. I have my weekly box office reports and reviews and columns here and there.
Nice. And of course, your blog. Yeah. MirrorEsque.blogspot.com. Thank you for dropping by.
Thank you.
I have to admit, when I first came up with the idea of bringing together six guests for this one episode, I thought to myself that this was either going to be a very good idea or a very, very bad idea, and I'm so really glad that it came together as well as it did. The credit for that goes to my guests, both for being such good sports and for being so accommodating towards this really mad caper of mine. Speaking of my guests, please check the show notes for this episode. That you can find that at thematinee.ca/episode107. It'll include links to all of the posts that my guests did where they got further in depth than the runtime of my podcast allows. My deepest thanks again go out to Geta, Met, Danny, Shantanu, James, and Amir. Their sites and Twitter handles can be all found in the show notes. That's it for episode 107. Come on back on Monday, March 17th. For episode 108, we'll be discussing the new Wes Anderson joint, The Grand Budapest Hotel. My site is thematinee.ca. For more podcast content, you can find back episodes by going to thematinee.ca/podcasting. You can also find them on Blueberry, Apple's podcasting app, Stitcher Radio, and the iTunes Store. They all give you handy ways to subscribe for free and get alerts when new episodes drop. Feedback on any of the films we described that we talked about today, or your own blind spots if you want to join the series, by all means, jump in, the water's warm, can be left in the comments section of the site. You can email Ryan at thematinee.ca. You can find me on Twitter, where I'm matinee_ca, or Facebook, facebook.com/darkmatinee. For Geta, Met, Danny, Shantanu, Jason, and Amir, I'm Ryan, and we'll see you at the matinee.